Welcome to the Thomistic Institute podcast. Our mission is to promote the Catholic intellectual tradition in the university, the church, and the wider public square. The lectures on this podcast are organized by university students at Thomistic Institute chapters around the world. To learn more and to attend these events, visit us at ThomisticInstitute.org.
Today, I'm supposed to tell you about how... So I'm supposed to because Father Davenport told me what I was supposed to do. Tell you about how planetary science, as a sort of a derivative field of the basic sciences, really unifies the search for life beyond the Earth. And it's a pleasure to do that because I am a planetary scientist, and so most of my research over the last 40, 45 years has been in that area. So it's kind of a fun exercise to go through and think about how planetary science relates to the other sciences. So if we go back to a time before 1960, planetary science, which is the study of the planets in our solar system, and since the 1990s, the planets around other stars that are known to exist, really planetary science didn't exist as a field. There was astronomy, which was the study of the heavens. There was geology, of course there was chemistry and physics as well, and atmospheric science. But planetary science kind of came into its own with the space age. And prior to that, if you think about when astronomy kind of came into its own as a quantitative field in the 1600s and 1700s, it was really with the understanding that space was enormously large, enormously larger than people had thought before. That really, I think, opened the door to what we call the modern field of astronomy. And it was not the measurement of stellar distances by parallax. It was actually the measurement of stellar distances by the aberration of starlight, almost a century after Galilei, that made people realize how big the universe really is. In geology, it was really in the late 1700s with the realization that the Earth was far older than people had thought before, that the modern field of geology came to be. And so as the abyss of space and the abyss of time, you're right, it does fight, doesn't it? It won't close. The abyss of space and the abyss of time that really made people realize that there was this enormously more complex and intricate universe than had been thought of before. And planetary science then, was a part of that, but not a lot was learned about the planets from telescopes, and you couldn't really go visit them, so there were a lot of speculations that turned out to be wrong about Venus being a sort of a tropical ocean world with trees and sea creatures and things like that. And so the study of life on other worlds was sort of put off into the periphery because of that lack of understanding. But when space exploration began in the late 50s and early 60s, it became possible to actually visit the planets. And then planetary science as a field came into its own. And it was possible to apply not only geology, but also the atmospheric sciences and the study of plasmas in space and the form of space physics to the study of planetary science. And that really became the sort of center of gravity, if you will, of that field. Astronomy was a little bit more peripheral. And so the question of whether there was life elsewhere began to center on Mars, because Venus was ruled out with its massive greenhouse atmosphere as a place where life could exist today. Modulo this suggestion that maybe there's microbial life in the clouds of Venus. But it was really the question of whether Mars might have life. And then after the turn of the 21st century, things changed again. And with the discovery of planets around other stars, the question of whether you could determine whether those planets might be able to host life and whether life actually existed there became important again. With large space telescopes like Hubble and James Webb and then the Nancy Grace Roman telescope, which will be launched in 2 years, and ALMA on the Earth and other future telescopes, the idea that you might be able to detect life beyond our solar system came into its own. And also, in our own solar system, the exploration of the outer solar system revealed that there were places moons around the giant planets that have liquid water oceans under their surfaces. And so maybe they have life. And so the whole question of life on other worlds began to be more generalized. And astronomy and in situ sciences, geology, atmospheric science, space physics, kind of became balanced again. So why is there such an interesting challenge in trying to understand whether life exists elsewhere? Well, the reason for that gets down to the whole question of chemistry and the biochemistry of life. Abiotic chemistry, chemistry in the absence of life, tends to produce a wide range of diverse compounds, but they're not very complex in the sense that they don't have a lot of structure or information contained in them. And they tend to get lost in this forest of other molecules that are much simpler, that have, for example, if you think of organic molecules, typical organic reactions will produce a sort of a distribution of molecules with a carbon number, a sort of a Poisson distribution. But life uses very specific, very limited sets of information-rich molecules that it puts together itself, the proteins, the RNA, the DNA. So there must have been a bottleneck in the origin of life on Earth. And the question of how narrow that bottleneck really was in transitioning from non-life to life is very much germane to the question of whether life might have started elsewhere in the universe as part of the unfolding of the evolution of the cosmos through secondary causes, through the instrumental causes that are governed by the physical laws that we know today. So there are people who do experiments and theory on the origin of life, but from my personal point of view, I think that the most fruitful way to determine whether life began elsewhere is to actually go to places and observe places in the universe where potentially life might exist. Go to these places directly if they're in our solar system, look at them with powerful astronomical telescopes if we're talking about places outside our solar system. So I want to spend most of my time on the search for life in the solar system, and then if I have time left over, I'll talk about looking for life outside the solar system. The four places, the four places where the search for life, at least at the moment, is likely to be most promising are shown here. And so, well, that doesn't work on a screen like that, so I'll just gesticulate. So those four places are Mars, Jupiter's moon Europa, and Saturn's moons Enceladus and Titan. Mars, because 60 years really of Mars exploration has shown that there really was a much more Earth-like environment on the surface of Mars during the first quarter of its history, during its first billion years. And the question of why that went away, how that went away, and whether life began on Mars and either persists to the present or might be recorded in sediments today on Mars, those are really the open questions. Europa, Enceladus, and Titan, these moons of the outer solar system, all have liquids either on their surface or underneath their surface. Europa and Enceladus, liquid water. Titan, liquid methane. And so the question whether life might exist in those places is an interesting one. So let's start with Mars. So Mars has been, as I said, a place where there has been a much stronger focus on exploration than any other places in the solar system, in part because it's close, in part because we have this cultural fascination with Mars, you know, War of the Worlds, Edgar Rice Burroughs, etc. And it turns out that after a decade where it looked like Mars might be more like the moon than like the Earth, more powerful instruments put into orbit revealed that, yes, Mars did have an epoch where it was rather Earth-like, where there was standing water and flowing water on the surface. And in the last 15 years, very capable rovers have been put on the surface with devices to either measure in situ the chemistry of the rocks or to drill and collect material for return to the Earth, something that the return has not happened yet, but we hope will happen. So the two most capable rovers, which were designed and built by the place where I work now, Jet Propulsion Laboratory, are called Curiosity and Perseverance. Curiosity was delivered to the surface in 2012, Perseverance in 2021. Curiosity has an analytic laboratory built into it that analyzes samples. Perseverance has a very complex sample collection, retrieval, and storage system that's built into it, collecting samples there. So these are images from the Curiosity rover, which landed at Gale Crater, which, based on data from orbit, suggested there might have been liquid water present, and it's found ample evidence of liquid water in Gale Crater billions of years ago, not there now, but you can see some of the images that show poorly sorted pebbles and so forth that clearly had been moved around and tumbled and shaped by liquid water. And there is chemical evidence as well. There's the presence of carbonates and sulfates that are minerals that indicate the past presence of water. So this is an area where there's a channel. I keep pointing with this thing. I shouldn't do that. On the left. And on the right, though, is what you most typically see in Gale Crater, which is all of these sediments that were laid down not by water, but almost certainly by wind. And so Mars has evolved from a world with standing liquid water to a world with no water at the surface except in frozen form, and a geology that's driven by aeolian processes, wind-driven processes. And other spacecraft have shown that Mars probably lost its water because the atmosphere gradually eroded away by impacts, by erosion from the solar wind, the charged particles from the sun. Being a small planet, Mars doesn't have a magnetic field, intrinsic magnetic field, which could protect that atmosphere. And so gradually over time, that atmosphere was lost. The air became colder and drier. Some of the carbon dioxide that made that atmosphere formed carbonates that have now been found on the surface by Curiosity rover, a mineral called siderite. So this whole picture has been painted through a combination of studies of the geology, what does the surface look like, the chemistry of the surface, what kinds of minerals are present, and the physics of how atmospheres are lost and how the climate changes. The Perseverance rover is in a place called Jezero Crater, and that's a very interesting location because it is an impact crater caused by a large asteroid that hit the surface. The crater is 50 kilometers across, but you can see on the left side is shown the western edge of that crater, and you can see that fan-shaped feature that's inside the crater, just inside of where that river channel called Neretva Vallis cut through the crater wall. And that geologic feature, that fan-shaped feature, is very recognizable from the Earth. It would be a river delta on the Earth, and it's caused by the slowing down of water that had been channelized in a river pouring out into a broader expanse. The water slows down and it dumps its load of sediments. You see that in the Mississippi River Delta, for example, at the Gulf of Mexico, the mouth of the river there. That's an ancient river delta or delta fan because you can see, if you look up close, a little spot that's an impact crater about a kilometer across called Belva, nice name. And that indicates that this feature is billions of years old. There are several other craters there too. The cratering rate is such that this indicates that this is a very ancient feature. The water stopped flowing billions of years ago. We're looking at a fossilized, essentially fossilized river system from billions of years before. If we could date that material directly and date the age of the crater with techniques that still require bringing material back to the Earth, that would be a very, very important tie point. We only have very approximate dates for this. In that region as well, there is material which has organic molecules in it, that has minerals that could be utilized by microorganisms or could have been utilized when there's liquid water. for sources of energy? Did microbes actually use those energy sources? Again, we need to bring the samples back to the Earth. So Perseverance is collecting those samples, but it also carried with it an amazing device, a helicopter, which is called Ingenuity. Now, the air pressure on Mars today is less than 1% of the air pressure on the Earth. It's like being up at 90,000 feet in the Earth's atmosphere, and so to operate a helicopter under those conditions requires a tremendous amount of ingenious engineering, hence Ingenuity. The rotor blades on that little helicopter spun at up to 2,900 RPM, which is 10 times faster than the helicopter blades in a helicopter on the Earth. And it operated for 70 flights. And initially it was an engineering experiment, and then it became a kind of a faithful servant to fly ahead and map out where there might be some interesting samples to collect. And so you see in that image on the right, from the Ingenuity helicopter, you can see the Perseverance rover in the upper left-hand side. And Ingenuity was very useful in mapping out where there were things like mudstones and so on that could be collected. So an amazing experiment. Organic molecules have been found on Mars. The Curiosity rover found long-chain hydrocarbons that might be remnants of fatty acids or might have been formed abiotically. That was a surprise. And then Perseverance has collected samples like the one on the right, where the little red circles are millimeters in size. And that sample comes from the edge of that river feature, Neretva Vallis. And in that one sample are carbonates, carbon dioxide that had been fixed in the sample, iron and phosphorus in the little bright white nodules, which you can't see, are surrounded by little rims. And when a geologist sees that in ancient rocks on the Earth, that's where microbial activity had occurred to utilize the energy associated with those minerals. Now, are there fossilized microbes in these samples? Cannot tell from the instruments on Perseverance. To answer that question, those samples have to be brought back to the Earth. So Mars is a fascinating place where life might have begun, and to really understand what happened there will require bringing samples back. So let me go now to the outer solar system, to Europa, which is a lunar-sized world orbiting Jupiter, one of the Galilean satellites, what Galileo called the Medicean stars in honor of his patron. And Europa, we now strongly suspect, or I would say maybe know at some level, has a liquid water ocean under its surface. And the best evidence for that comes not from looking at the surface, although the surface of Europa is bright, it's fractured, it has no impact craters except for one or two. It looks like the ice has been broken apart and rafted and moved around, so that suggests a liquid water ocean. But it doesn't tell you whether that ocean's there today. What does tell you that that ocean is there today is very basic, honest-to-goodness electromagnetism, physics. And the detection of that ocean is somewhat related to how you detect coins in the sand on the beach with a metal detector. The Galileo orbiter, which orbited Jupiter in the 1990s, had a device for measuring magnetic fields. Jupiter has a powerful magnetic field, much stronger than that of the Earth. The field lines of that magnetic field pass through the region where the Galilean satellites are, like Europa. And because the field is tilted, the axis of the magnetic field is tilted relative to the rotation axis of Jupiter, and the satellites orbit 90 degrees to that rotation axis, it means that the magnetic field, the local magnetic field from Jupiter that each of those satellites feels, varies in time because it bobs up and down. Now, if you put an electrical conductor into a time-varying magnetic field, you will generate secondary magnetic fields that result in this picture on the right, where the field lines of Jupiter, the primary field lines, look like they're being pushed away. And they're pushed away because that time-varying field induces electric fields inside the conductor, what are called eddy currents, and those eddy currents generate a secondary magnetic field. Newton's law, every action causes an equal and opposite reaction, so that secondary field acts to push the primary field away. And that's exactly what the Galileo orbiter detected on multiple flybys, and is very strong evidence for electrically conducting material near the surface of Europa, not deep down where there might be an iron core, but close to the surface. That's required by the observations. So here, basic physics tells you something about the nature of this material. Geology, on the other hand, tells you that interesting things are actually going on in the crust of Europa. So here's an image taken by another spacecraft, the Juno spacecraft, of this feature about 50 kilometers across in the lower right. I'm on the team that did this. We like to call that feature the platypus. You can see the two eyes in the lower right and the snout at the bottom and the body at the top, especially if you squint. I mean, it's like constellations, right? Does that really look like Orion the Hunter? Yeah. So anyway, the platypus is indicative of melting in the crust and injection of warm liquid, probably salty liquid, into that region. And if you look at the cracks in the upper right part, you can see dark splotches. And those dark splotches may be material that's in the liquid water under the surface, coming up to the surface and being darkened by the very intense radiation environment that Europa is in. That intense radiation is particles, subatomic particles, protons, and electrons, accelerated by Jupiter's magnetic field. But there's other evidence from astronomy that there is material coming up from the ocean in these regions. And that comes from telescopes like Hubble Space Telescope and James Webb Space Telescope on the left and the right, neither of which are anywhere close to Jupiter. They're in orbit around the Earth. James Webb is a million miles away in a place called the Lagrange 2 point. And they're powerful enough that they can resolve the surface of Europa, and they have what are called spectrometers that break the light up into its component wavelengths, and by looking at the pattern of the dips and peaks, you can infer composition. So Hubble discovered that in these fractured regions with features like the platypus, areas that are outlined in black on that left-hand figure, there's a concentration of sodium chloride, table salt. That sodium chloride suggests that ocean material is welling up. In order to get the high electrical conductivity in water, adding salt is very, very helpful. And so the Galileo measurements suggest there's salt, and indeed there's sodium chloride in the regions that are most fractured on Europa. And on the right-hand side, in those same regions, the James Webb Space Telescope, at a different range of wavelengths, found carbon dioxide. Carbon dioxide might be in the ocean. James Webb says it is. That's telling us that that ocean has some interesting material in it. But does it have organic molecules? And are these features really concentrated right where the fractures are? Well, you can't tell that from the Earth. So you have to go back to Europa to do that. And this is the Europa Clipper spacecraft, which was built both at JPL and also at Applied Physics Lab. It's a very large spacecraft. You see people at the bottom there. The solar panels that power Europa Clipper, when they're fully extended now, they span a basketball court. So it's the largest planetary spacecraft ever launched. And one of the perks of my job was that not only did I get to go to the launch because I'm involved in Clipper, but I got to get up close to the rocket before it launched, of course. And then there's the launch itself. So this is an example of new space in the sense that while JPL and APL built the spacecraft, NASA contracted the launch with SpaceX, and the SpaceX launch was about one-third the cost of what launching government launches would have been in the past. So it's on its way to Jupiter, and Europa will make 50 flybys of Europa and make a variety of measurements. These are different instruments. The ones in red are mass spectrometers. I'll tell you what those do in a few minutes. The white instruments are remote sensing instruments. And this is a mission that will utilize all the basic sciences, geology, physics, chemistry, atmospheric science, space physics, to provide an answer to whether that ocean material is really coming out onto the surface and whether what's in the ocean could sustain life, has the right energy, metabolism, pH, acidity, et cetera, that would allow life to be sustained. So I want to move on now to Saturn's moon Enceladus. So we've gone from Jupiter to Saturn. In contrast to Europa, Enceladus is quite small compared to the Earth's moon. Now, Europa is able to maintain its ocean not only because of the radioactive decay of the rock in its interior, but also because of tidal heating from Jupiter. Enceladus appears to be reliant mostly on tidal heating from Saturn, because it's really so small that the heat from radioactive decay and the rock itself, the uranium, the potassium, the thorium, that wouldn't be enough to sustain an ocean. Surprisingly, it has an ocean, and that was discovered by the Cassini-Huygens mission. That was a mission that was launched in 1997. It's another large spacecraft, but it was powered by plutonium decay, not by solar energy. So it has a somewhat different configuration. And that gold disk that you see in the middle we'll encounter in a few minutes. That was the Huygens probe, named after Christian Huygens, that landed on the surface of Titan. But as far as Enceladus goes, it has this plume of material pouring out of the South Polar region, coming out of fractures in the form of jets that you see in the lower left, the fractures you see in the lower right. That was a big surprise, but it was also a great opportunity because it allowed Cassini, which happened to carry instruments that could analyze material in situ for other objects, to utilize those at Enceladus. So once Cassini discovered those jets by imaging and also by magnetometry, it was determined that it would be safe to fly Cassini through the plume itself, formed by those jets, and analyze that material directly. So a mass spectrometer is a device that measures the mass over charge of individual ions. And so it works by taking in atoms, ionizing them, stripping off an electron, and then those charged atoms are forced through either a magnetic field or an electric field, which is constant. And so the heavier charged particles move more slowly, the lighter charged particles move more quickly. So by measuring the traverse time inside the instrument, as you see in the lower left, that's one kind of mass spectrometer, it's possible to determine the identity of those atoms and ions, a very fundamental chemical analytic tool that's been put in space in the service of planetary science. So here's an example from a fly-through of the Cassini of the Enceladus plume by Cassini. You see on the lower right, the y-axis is the amplitude of the signal. The x-axis is the time of traverse of these individual ions through the instrument between two charged plates. And that gives you the molecular weight, which you can't see because the image is too small. But what's shown there is in blue, the peaks are various water species complexed with oxygen and hydrogen. The yellow are peaks corresponding to sodium-bearing material. The orange is a calibration. And then the orange bars, but the horizontal orange labeled as HMOC, those are all separated by 12 or 13 mass units, which is either carbon or carbon hydrogen. So those are organic molecules. Their specific identity, this kind of mass spectrometer can't tell you, but a better mass spectrometer could do that. Nonetheless, this material coming out of Enceladus through the plume into space says there's organic matter inside of Enceladus. And there are other techniques that Cassini used to determine that what's present in the interior is in fact liquid water. I don't have time to go through those techniques, but there were three different ones that pretty convincingly tell us there's an ocean underneath the ice crust of Enceladus, and sitting below that ocean, as is the case for Europa as well, is a rocky core that provides nutrients, potential nutrients. In fact, one of the things that the Cassini mass spectrometers detected was silica, SiO2, which evidently comes from the reaction of the rocky seafloor with the water itself, much as what we see in terrestrial hydrothermal systems. And so there are chemical reactions with the rock, there's organic molecules, there are salts. Does this ocean sustain life? Well, again, Cassini can't tell us the answer to that, but there are some exercises you can play, and here's one. You can make the postulate that maybe life actually is utilizing energy in the form of converting carbon dioxide with hydrogen into methane and water, what's called a methanogen. There are methanogenic organisms in the seafloor of the Earth. And there's carbon dioxide and hydrogen and methane and water all discovered by the Cassini mass spectrometer. So the question is, are those four molecules, as far as we can tell from the Cassini data, are they in chemical equilibrium, which would tell you that that ocean is basically dead? So you can make a chart where the y-axis is a measure of how far from equilibrium the system is, and the x-axis would be whatever variable you want to consider, in this case, the ratio of hydrogen to water. And this, technically, this is something called the chemical affinity, and the chemical affinity is calculated by taking the actual abundances of these species, forming them into a factor in an equation that has to do with the abundances of the reactants, which are the carbon dioxide and the hydrogen, and the products, which are the methane and the water. And then calculating the same thing in chemical equilibrium, which you can easily do as a chemistry exercise for a given temperature and acidity. You have to know the acidity. So if you're above that line on this graph, there's energy available for food, to use that reaction for food, if you will. If you're below that line, you have to put in energy to produce the methane. So how does it look on Enceladus? Well, it looks like this. So the pH is known from the measurement of the salts and chlorine that's there. So those diagonal lines are pH lines. And we know how much hydrogen is there from Cassini, and there's a little table on the left for the other constituents. And so Enceladus's ocean sits in the blue box as far as this metabolic reaction goes. That is well above equilibrium. In fact, it's embarrassingly above equilibrium. It's as if you walked into a pizza parlor and they had been making pizza like crazy and no one's eating the pizza, so it's just stacked up to the walls. However, there are microbes, there are microbial systems on the Earth that do actually reach that level above equilibrium where this their ecology is limited by certain nutrients, other elements, if you will, that don't allow them to fully utilize the carbon dioxide that's there to make methane. So this does sort of overlap with the terrestrial microbial system, and it does suggest that maybe this ocean is in a kind of an interesting state. It's not dead. It has the ability to provide energy for microorganisms, but to know if those microorganisms are there requires going back with much better mass spectrometers to fly through the plume again and determine if the actual metabolic products of a real biological system are present in that plume. So let me turn now to Titan. Titan is a very different case where it's, first of all, much larger than the Earth's moon. If Titan suddenly appeared in the sky at the distance of the Earth's moon, we would say, whoa, that's really something. It's bigger than the planet Mercury. And Titan is the only moon with a very dense atmosphere. It has an atmosphere four times the air density of the Earth at the surface. It is very cold, being out at Saturn. The surface of Enceladus, by the way, is 70 degrees above absolute zero. Where the plume is, it's very warm. Titan's surface is warmed by a greenhouse effect associated with the methane to the balmy temperature of 94 Kelvin, or minus 292 degrees Fahrenheit. When I taught at Cornell, I would always joke that, you know, it was just a little bit colder than an Ithaca winter, but now I'm in Pasadena, so I can't joke about that. But Titan's surface is obscured by haze. And it was not until Voyager 1 flew by in 1980 using a radio, beaming a radio signal through the atmosphere that the density of the atmosphere was known. And then from the Cassini-Huygens mission, we now know what's at the surface. So the Huygens probe, which was in that golden disk, there's an artist concept of it lying on the surface after its parachute descent to the surface. It was built by the European Space Agency. It took these very interesting images of the surface in the upper left, showing a gully system, not carved by liquid water at 94 Kelvin, but that's a perfect temperature for liquid methane. And then in the upper right is a map of features seen by the radar on the main spacecraft, the Cassini orbiter. Radar, radio waves penetrate through the haze, penetrate through the atmosphere. And the color is all false. It's a single wavelength, so really think of that as black and white. The darker areas are smooth. Radar sees in this kind of imaging technique dark areas as very smooth. The bright areas are very rough. But you can actually do an experiment with the radar to determine if those dark areas are liquid. And that's what was done with Cassini, by pointing the antenna and the radar system straight down and sending a radio signal down into those dark areas. If you get a bounce from the top and then a second bounce a little bit later, that indicates that that material is transparent enough to allow radio waves to propagate through it. And so that little color chart in the lower left shows the radar reflection from the sea surface that is very straight and very strong. And then you see that sort of fainter red and yellow signal that has a maximum time delay in the center of what we now call Ligia Mare, and has a time delay corresponding to a depth of about 150 meters. So that means the material is very radio transparent. This wavelength is 2 centimeters. And to get a signal to go 300 meters down and up and be detectable again by Cassini means this stuff is very radio transparent. So what materials can be that transparent? Well, the answer is methane and its sister hydrocarbons, ethane and propane. So at JPL, a little device was invented because it's so hard to measure the attenuation for such transparent materials. A little device there, which you see, the inner disk is about a centimeter across, was built. It's a resonant cavity. It amplifies the radio signals and therefore the microwave absorption inside the chamber. It was filled with liquid methane and ethane. The attenuations were measured for the first time in 2015, a year after the Cassini observations. And thanks to that, we know the ratio of methane to ethane in these seas from these remote observations. So very good microwave physics combined with chemistry tells us the composition of these weird seas a billion miles away from us. So NASA is sending a spacecraft called Dragonfly to Titan. It's actually a flying rover with a gravity that's about the gravity of the moon and an air density 4 times the air density on the Earth. This is a great place to go flying. I actually got to see the propellers at APL a couple of weeks ago. They look ridiculously small to carry a 300-kilogram rover in the air, but it's easy to fly there. So it will carry a chemical laboratory, unfortunately not to go to the seas, but to go to some of the solid hydrocarbon, solid organic areas on Titan and an impact crater. And so there, much like the Curiosity rover on Mars, geology will be done by imaging, chemistry by the chemistry experiments. There's a seismometer on this that will measure the possible seismic activity of Titan. And so there's the physics and also measurements of the atmosphere. So all of this wrapped together is doing planetary science on the surface of Titan, seeing if the precursors to life are there on the surface and if the chemistry has evolved from that of the atmosphere. Methane and nitrogen in the atmosphere get converted to other organic molecules and nitriles by ultraviolet light. But when they get to the surface where there is no more ultraviolet light, does chemistry keep going on? Is there some sort of chemistry occurring at the surface? And so Dragonfly will tell us that. So in the last minute of my time, I want to just briefly talk about the search for life in planets around other stars. So there are now 6,000 known and confirmed planets around other stars. One wants to look for places where there might be surfaces like that of the Earth, where these planets are orbiting around their stars at just the right distance for liquid water. However, most of these planets have been detected by the so-called transit technique, where the planet passes in front of the star and blocks the light, partially the light of the star. The probability of a transit is much, much higher if the planet is very close to the star rather than at the corresponding distance that the Earth is from the Sun. So most of these planets that we know of are in very close orbits around their stars, and only for the very coolest stars would that be... Yes, I forgot when I set my alarm it would do that. Stop! Okay. I'll just take 3 more minutes. So just from most of these planets, because the probability of a transit is much higher if the planet is close to its star, those are very close to their parent stars. And the only ones of those that would be habitable would be orbiting around the very coolest stars, the so-called M dwarfs. And they would have a rather complicated kind of climate. But nonetheless, we're interested in looking, and one of the things that has become clear is that not all types of planets are represented in our own solar system. If Shakespeare had expressed this, he would have said there are more kinds of Earths in the heavens, Horatio, than are dreamt of in your philosophy. And this is one example of that. There are a number of planets that are in between the size of the Earth and Neptune. And they could be super-Earths, which are on the lower left, where they're rocky worlds with a lot of ice and maybe liquid water. Or they could be mini-Neptunes on the right, where they have mostly hydrogen along with ice and rock. Or they could be something in between that's been called Hycean worlds by Nicu Medusadon at Cambridge. So Hycean is an abbreviation of hydrogen and ocean, where they have a shell of hydrogen overlying an ocean. And trying to determine that requires understanding the chemistry, because from the light that these planets produce, you only really know what's in the atmosphere. The way that you determine their composition is in one of two ways with existing space telescopes. Either the planet passes in front of the star, again blocks part of the light of the star, and the amount of light that it blocks, the planet's apparent size, is a function of what wavelength of light you're looking at. Where you're looking at wavelengths where there are a lot of absorbers in the atmosphere, the planet looks bigger. Where you're looking at wavelengths where there aren't, the planet looks smaller. The other is you can look at the star-planet system just before the planet passes behind the star. Okay, at that point, the planet is at full phase, and you get a spectrum combined of the star and the planet, because even our most powerful space telescopes can't distinguish the two if the planet's at a close distance. And then when the planet passes behind, you get another spectrum, and that's the planet of the spectrum of the star. And so you subtract the spectrum of the star from the spectrum of the combined two, and you get that of the planet. This requires tremendous accuracy, stability, and also high sensitivity. And although this has been possible to some extent with Hubble Space Telescope, it's really the James Webb Space Telescope that has been able to make these spectra for a variety of planets. So here's a somewhat artistically redoctored spectrum of a planet K2-18b, which is sub-Neptune or super-Earth or Hycean world. This is the wavelengths of light ranging from about 1 micron on the left to 5 microns on the right, Remember, visible light is about 0.6 microns, 0.5 microns. And then the amount of light is the y-axis. So this is an absorption spectrum. So where there are features, you would see dips in the light. The actual data are shown with the dots and the error bars. It looks pretty ratty, but this is a relatively small world. But a modeling of that spectrum to fit it shows that there's methane, carbon dioxide in the atmosphere, and controversially something called dimethyl sulfide, which is potentially a biosignature in the atmosphere, but it turns out its detection in this spectrum is questionable. When this sort of press release version came out, the argument was it's sort of at the 2-sigma level, which is just, or 3-sigma level, which is, you know, barely from a statistical point of view believable, but now that with more observations, it's down sort of below 1-sigma. So it's challenging observation, but it's astronomy put in the service of planetary science together with physics and chemistry. So how does planetary science unify the search for life beyond Earth? Well, first of all, it was born from other traditional fields, geology, astronomy, atmospheric science, and space physics. But then when planetary exploration became possible, and large telescopes as well, then later were launched, it was really planetary science that became the sort of unifying nexus around which all these other fields are applied. So is planetary science then, in terms of the search for life, the mother science? I still think the basic sciences are physics, chemistry, etc. But it's a way of bringing all these different techniques together to learn about places that up till now were really just points of light or little disks in the sky. And that has really, I would say, revolutionized our understanding of the cosmos, because it's shown how complex and how diverse planets can be and how complicated their histories are and how different they are from the Earth. And that, I think, will pave the way in the next 10 or 20 years for experiments that will actually discover life in places like Europa and Enceladus, maybe Titan. And if we ever get samples back from Mars, there might be fossilized microbes there as well. But also, planetary science is fun. And for the launch of Europa Clipper, there was a hurricane that came through. All our flights were canceled. I managed to get another flight. My wife, who was still packing the house up in Ithaca, couldn't get another flight. So she said, "Well, take a selfie of yourself with the launch." I said, "That's impossible." And she said, no, try it." And so I rehearsed it before the launch. And then after liftoff, I turned around, and sure enough, it worked. So I hope that's not the greatest accomplishment of my career, but it could be. Anyway, thank you all. Bye. Thanks so much.
Thanks for listening to this lecture on the Thomistic Institute podcast. The generosity of people like you makes this podcast possible. If you enjoy these talks, please consider showing your support at www.thomisticinstitute.org/donate. Your donation of even a dollar helps us reach more college students and many others with the powerful truths of the faith, and it ensures that we can keep publishing top-notch lectures on this podcast. Thanks a lot.